Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The first COVID vaccinations in the U.S. are happening. And before we go any further, I just want to take a moment to celebrate how amazing that is. It's the fastest vaccine development program in human history. Now, I was just looking back at some old On Point shows last night, and on April 14th, we talked with a vaccine researcher who said that nothing like this has ever happened before. And 8 months later now, almost to the day, we have not just one, but possibly two COVID vaccines, because the FDA could grant emergency authorization for Moderna's vaccine later this week. Now, I am a lover of science, so I just want to say thank you to all the scientists and researchers around the world who have shown us what is possible with expert minds, focus, collaboration, and profound effort. You see, the pandemic, it's revealed the disasters that befall us when we don't act with focus, when we don't act with collaboration and effort. But science has shown us the good that can come when we do. And of course, after every and any major milestone, there is also a whole new road ahead, a whole new field of questions. So today I'm talking with Professor Yolanda Wilson. And Professor Wilson, here's my question. Is the first COVID vaccine being distributed in the right way? Not just technically, but ethically. I mean, who should get the vaccine first?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me today. I'm very excited to chat about the vaccine and vaccine distribution, and particularly the ethics involved. So I want to think about, we've had a lot of conversation about healthcare workers receiving the vaccine first. And I certainly think that that is a right path to take. However, I want to be sure that we are intentional about being expansive and being inclusive in who gets counted as healthcare workers, right? A lot of the popular conversation tends to focus on, for instance, physicians and nurses. And while I certainly think that they are important, I think it's also important to remember that the people who make healthcare happen aren't all physicians and nurses. We have people who work in cafeterias. We have people who work in what is now called in many places environmental services. So orderlies, housekeeping staff. And often, you know, at the height of the pandemic, they did not receive the same amount of PPE and they didn't have the same access to PPE, and yet they were still vulnerable. And so when we think about people like healthcare workers having access to the vaccine, I want us to be intentional and be expansive about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yolanda Wilson is a professor of philosophy at Howard University. She's a fellow at the National Humanities Center and also served as visiting scholar in bioethics at the National Institutes of Health. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point from NPR and WBUR. And we thought that today was a good day to have this conversation, not just about vaccinations, but more broadly about what the pandemic has revealed, the mirror that it's held up to the ethical questions and challenges and conundrums that are presented day in and day out in American healthcare. So, Professor Wilson, I'm very grateful that you could join us to sort of travel through these questions. So thinking about what you're saying, just expanding the circle of who's considered a healthcare worker. Did you see adequate evidence of that when, for example, I mean, the CDC did think through their recommendations for vaccination scheduling?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So certainly those conversations are happening. And, you know, I think sometimes what happens, though, in actuality is once we filter down, sometimes things get lost in translation or in conversation or intention. And so I think that's why, for me, it's important to emphasize these less publicly discussed aspects of healthcare work, because it's still very important work. And I also want us to be inclusive about people who engage in healthcare work in homes, because I think, you know, sometimes those workers get overlooked. Again, in actuality, in practice, despite what kind of high level conversations or what the intentions can be around what we hope to see.
Well, on this question of healthcare workers in particular, sticking with that for a second, I want to play something for you, Professor Wilson, because we heard an interview on All Things Considered last week, NPR's All Things Considered, with Dr. Joel Zivit, who works in the ICU in a hospital in Atlanta. And here's what he said about his priority status for receiving a vaccination.
What troubles me is that I feel like now I'm trading off, I don't know, my convenience for your death. Sure, we want to be given the means to do our job, but we can do our job if you give us supplies. Give us the right number of supplies and the right number of space. Let's just say that you vaccinate everyone in an ICU and everyone, and in every case, the vaccination works and confers some kind of immunity. I still have an ICU full of patients who are dying, and that's the problem.
So, Professor Wilson, it sounds to me like Dr. Zivit there is saying he might be receive some vaccine-based immunity, but perhaps that's not the right ethical decision if there are so many people who have not and are still pouring into the hospital.
Absolutely. So for me, right. I mean, so we know in the very early stages, right, these very, very first doses, we're going to have a lot of people who aren't covered. That's just kind of the fact of the matter. And, you know, maybe even, you know, I've been talking about being expansive in how we think about healthcare workers, but maybe we need to be more fine grained about, you know, who has a little bit more flexibility in the kinds of healthcare work they do, who has a little bit more access to PPE. I mean, so, you know, I was thinking about this in light of being expansive, but maybe that also needs to be something that we are explicit about so that we can protect those who are most vulnerable. One thing that we do know is that even among healthcare workers, lots who have contracted COVID have been these more vulnerable workers in environmental services, for example. And so maybe some of those efforts, if we're going to think about healthcare work as a category, need to be concentrated there. I also think, of course, and, you know, this has come up in lots of the discussions around vaccine distribution. Of course, people who have certain kinds of pre-existing health conditions. I would also say transit workers, grocery store workers, right? Those are the people who are interacting with the general public and who often don't have personal protective equipment, right? The person who's working in Target or Walmart or someplace like that, you know, they may have a mask, but, you know, they have lots of, they're interacting with lots of people who are coming in and off the street. And so they have a particular vulnerability just by virtue of the kind of work that they do.
Yeah. Well, I want to just play one more piece of tape from a hospital-based healthcare worker. And I want to come back to your point about other essential workers in just a second. But this is Sandra Lindsay, a critical care nurse in Long Island, New York, one of the first, if not the first American to be vaccinated with the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine yesterday. That's according to officials from the state of New York. And here is Sandra after she received that first shot.
It was an emotional experience. Working on the front lines alongside my team, I saw a lot of pain, hurt, suffering, death, and so I felt a huge sense of relief. I've been waiting for this day for forever. So I'm happy it's here. I'm grateful. that I had the opportunity to have access to the vaccine. And my hope is that in the coming months, more people around the world will have the same access.
That's Sandra Lindsay, a critical care nurse in Long Island. Now, Professor Wilson, when she talked about the pain, hurt, and suffering she had seen, that makes me wonder, what do you think the pandemic revealed about ethical decision-making that has to go on every day in the U.S. healthcare system? I mean, did we see a system that was equipped to be able to make the best decisions, the right decisions, whatever they are?
So first, let me just say, you could actually hear the pain in her voice, right? You could hear the quivering, the trauma, and the gratitude. I mean, she said, I'm grateful to receive this vaccine. And so one thing that I want to emphasize in the work that I do and in the conversation that you and I are having right now is that, you know, even if one is perfectly equipped, right, to think through these very difficult decisions, they are still very difficult decisions, right? And, you know, it can be traumatic to have to make these decisions. And so I think sometimes the weight of the decision making itself doesn't always receive the kind of appreciation that it should on the ground.
I completely agree. I do wonder how healthcare professionals travel through their careers without suffering some kind of moral wound just by virtue of the decisions that they have to make, like split second decisions every day. I mean, that weight, as you're talking about, it has to be with them for years on end.
Yeah. And so when you couple that with a response to pandemic that was not the best, I don't think I'm overstating to say that there was definitely room for improvement at the federal and state levels in particular. I think that that made the decision making even more difficult. And, you know, not all institutions have trained ethicists on board. And so a lot of decisions were really being made at bedside out of necessity. And I think that part of what this pandemic has revealed and gives us opportunity to think about is the role of ethics in healthcare.
So that's what we're going to talk about more when we come back from this quick break. Professor Yolanda Wilson, stand by. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before we get back to today's show, I just want to give you guys a preview of Thursday's show. We're going to be talking about the mutually beneficial impact of kindness, not just the impact it has on the person who's receiving the act of kindness, but the impact it has on the person giving it. So we want to hear your stories. Was there ever a time where you did something for someone else and you felt that actually you received the greater gift by being able to do that, by being able to give that act of kindness? Give us your story. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We'll be talking about kindness and its mutually beneficial impact on Thursday. Now, today, we are talking about ethical considerations in American medicine, in American healthcare, and the mirror that the pandemic has held up to bioethics in the United States. And I'm joined today by Yolanda Wilson. She's a professor of philosophy at Howard University, a fellow at the National Humanities Center, and former visiting scholar in bioethics at the National Institute of Health. And Professor Wilson, if you can just stand by here for a second, I want to bring in Akila Jefferson Shaw into the conversation. Dr. Shaw is an allergist, immunologist, and bioethicist at Arkansas Children's Hospital and a professor at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. And Dr. Shaw, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, can you tell me a little bit in your day-to-day work, the clinical portion of your work, how often do ethical considerations come into the mix for you?
Well, I would say almost every day. I'm mostly an outpatient provider, but I do take care of generally sick children, so those with immunodeficiencies and other immune system disorders. So we always have to think about what's best for the child going forward, particularly if they have very devastating illness. On the inpatient side, we get the same questions, premature children who come out, people who have very severe lung problems, things like that. And we think about quality of life, particularly for kids. And then on the adult side, similar issues that come up most days, I would say, for most physicians.
Mm. So it's an integral part of the work by definition, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, before we go further, maybe we should just take a second here to give everyone the same set of tools here. And so I'll ask both of you, and feel free, by the way, to jump in and on each other. I don't have to be in between the two of you too much here. But I'd love to get sort of like your definition. And Dr. Shaw, I'll just start with you here. But sort of how should we be thinking about what bioethics actually is in the context of American medicine?
Right. So I think bioethics is what we do. And I think that's the best way to think about it. I think historically, people think of bioethics as kind of a grand idea that is in the background, kind of in the clouds. That's not something that we are, actionable about on a day-to-day basis. And I always try to think of it as what we do every day. So how do we think about patients, not just their pathophysiology, but how do we think about their lives in general, which are much more than just what's happening in the body? How is it impacting themselves? How is it impacting their family? How do all of these outside experiences and things really impact the way that people's health evolves throughout their lifetime? And so thinking about things like social determinants of health, about racism, all of those things matter, and they are inclusive in bioethics. And so I think that's the best way to think about it.
Professor Wilson, go ahead.
Yeah, so I would just add to that. I think sometimes people who are skeptical about bioethics think that it constrains what it is that physicians in particular can do. And I think that if we think about ethical frameworks as guiding our deliberation, guiding how we encounter patients, guiding what we think is the right thing to do for patients, then I think we can see the value and the beauty of ethics.
Okay, so let's take it back down to the level of the pandemic then. I heard Dr. Shaw, I heard you say that bioethics is essentially what you do every day, not just specifically you, but healthcare does every day. How was that brought into even sharper relief in your experience? Through the pandemic?
Right. So I think one of the big issues that has come up in this pandemic is inequality throughout the healthcare system. And, in bioethics, we think about many, many things, but fairness and justice is a big thing that we think about every single day. And so this pandemic and the inequitable ways in which people have been impacted, whether it's from particular communities, urban places, rural places, whether it's based on race and ethnicity, so brown and black people being disproportionately impacted, indigenous communities being disproportionately impacted, whether it is sort of from you know, some people would say a socioeconomic status place where people who have more access to things like treatments and testing and all of that tend to do better than those who have a harder time getting to testing centers, a harder time getting to hospitals, more exposures based on where they work and where they live. And so, you know, all of that kind of comes together in the day-to-day impacts of COVID-19 and this pandemic. And so thinking about all of that and how we can make differences and how we make decisions to specifically address all of those issues, I think has been important.
Professor Wilson, did you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, actually, you know, I would also say, you know, so full disclosure, Dr. Jefferson and I have co-authored a few things together. So we know one another's work quite well. But one thing that I would add to what she said is, you know, the invisibility of people who are institutionalized. And by that, I mean, you know, we saw certainly at the height in the spring, well, the numbers are increasing again, but nursing places like nursing homes, where there were just, you know, incredible numbers of death proportionally, and also prisons. And I think that, you know, people feel lots of ways about prisons and prisoners. But the reality is those are confined spaces where people don't have the ability to move around and do things to protect themselves. And we saw significant outbreaks in jails and prisons. And, you know, those are also, for me, serious issues of bioethics, right? So I come to bioethics as a political philosopher, actually. And so I think about things like, what are the state's obligations to its citizens and its residents? And I think that prisons are, you know, they're a state institution. I know that there's a rise in private prisons, but to the extent that we're going to have a state that confines people, I think that there are certain obligations to the people who are experiencing that kind of confinement. So these detention centers for immigrants, prisons, jails, certain other kinds of state institutions like mental health institutions, for me, are places where bioethicists could and should think about what the unique issues are that contribute to a particular kind of vulnerability. And I think that, you know, the pandemic really highlighted just how quickly, for instance, contagious disease spreads through places like that where people are confined.
Mm-hmm. First of all, Dr. Jefferson, let me apologize because I was referring to you as Dr. Shaw, and it occurred to me that maybe that was a mistake. So my apologies for that.
Actually, I think I might be wrong. I keep forgetting that she's gotten married and that she uses Shaw now.
So. I go by both. It doesn't, whatever anyone calls me.
You tell me which one you prefer.
I go by Jefferson Shaw. Sounds good.
Okay, good. I'll get them both in there. My apologies. Names are important, so I want to get it right. But you know, so one of the things that I think that healthcare does in America is that it forces us to ask very, very important questions that the two of you, in fact, touched on. Because how do I put this? There are the ethical considerations and the ethical obligations that a doctor has to her patient, right? And then there are also the ethical obligations that maybe a healthcare system or Professor Wilson, as you were talking about, systems of government have to their communities. Now, I wonder, are those things often in conflict with each other? Dr. Jefferson Shaw, I'll turn to you for your first thoughts on that.
I do think they are sometimes in conflict, but I don't think that they have to be in conflict. So your point about kind of individual obligations that I might have to my particular patient versus obligations that my hospital system, the institution has to our communities or to our individual patients. Sometimes within the business of medicine, these lines get a little blurry. And sometimes what the system wants is not necessarily what the system needs. And so we try to balance that out, I think, a bit on the ground, particularly doctors and ethicists and philosophers and those people who work in these fields. With COVID-19, I would say that on an individual level, most doctors, we are trying to protect our patients. We're trying to figure out ways to decrease suffering. We're trying to figure out ways to make the best decisions as far as allocations and access and things of that nature. Mm. Within the system, hospital systems, I think we're probably on the same page. Everyone kind of has the same goal. How do we get this under control as quickly and as safely as possible for most people? Now, you get into, I think, once you get to a system level, other obligations that there are. So obligations to have the hospital continue to run, to make, you know, they have issues with money and things of that nature that also have to happen to keep the lights on in the building, right? And so sometimes those things get a little blurred, but in the end, I think most of the time, the overarching goal of most hospital systems, administrators, doctors, nurses, all of us kind of going through is to do the best thing for patients as much as we can. And so that hopefully wins out most of the time.
Okay, so let me put let me put some added detail in here with an example. So this year in New York State, there was, I believe, a panel of bioethics experts that included ethicists and physicians and lawyers and clergy philosophers, who I believe came up with guidelines for allocating ventilators in the pandemic when there was concern about potential ventilator shortage. So here's an example in which every doctor who has a patient that needs assistance breathing probably wants to be able to give them a ventilator as an ethical obligation to help care for them. And yet this group also was charged with coming up with a set of guidelines that had to take into account the whole community. So decisions were being made about who, I don't want to say who's more deserving, but who should get a ventilator over others. That's kind of a community level concern. So Professor Wilson, like, just help us think through that. How do you come up with those guidelines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right. So those kinds of guidelines, and I think this kind of goes back to the last segment where I talked about just the trauma of having to make certain kinds of decisions to begin with. So I think we have to take into account, of course, standardly ethicists take into account things like, of course, how many ventilators you have to begin with, how sick the population is. They may get into more fine-grained questions like quality of life years. And here's where you run into judgments that may actually reinforce inequality. So, you know, what happened in New York, we saw that there was concern and rightful concern, actually, among members of the disability community and people who just think about disability ethics, that given this focus on things like quality of life years, whatever that means, that often that's framed in a way that is ableist, right? That's built where the presumption that one's quality of life is somehow diminished by the mere fact of having certain health conditions or being of a certain age. And so while there are lots of factors that we have to take into account, it's also the space where biases can creep in, even unintentionally, where we have to be very careful about reinforcing the kind of systemic inequality that has created this differential impact in the first place. So I can't give, right? I don't know if you were hoping for like the 1, 2, 3, here's the precise answer. But I do want us to think about some of the issues to keep in mind as these kinds of decisions have to be made. And this isn't the first time. And unfortunately, it probably won't be the last time.
Right. In fact, I would say that the de facto, these decisions, these kinds of decisions are being made all the time. Mm-hmm. The question is, do the people who are having to make these decisions, do they have the right set of tools or the time to even think through them? Now, we've got to take another break in just a couple of minutes, but I just want to hit this straight on. For the sake of argument, let us presume for at least a moment that the American healthcare system simply is fundamentally inequitable, right? We have still millions of Americans who don't have health insurance. Some people can, say, easily get a quadruple bypass if they happen to live near a city hospital, for example. Others struggle to get prenatal care. I mean, there are inequities already built in to this system. So in a fundamentally inequitable healthcare system, is it even possible at all to make ethical decisions? Or is any outcome going to be basically unethical, Professor Wilson?
You know, it's so interesting because this is the question that I struggle with in my own work and that I think through in my own work. I certainly think that the way that a lot of ethical decision making happens now occurs against a kind of theoretical backdrop of kind of a presumed reasonably just society. And I think if that is the framework within which one is operating, they're going to continually be these kinds of inequalities, and actually they're going to be made worse, these inequities. However, I think that if you take as a starting point the fundamental inequality in society, right, these fundamental inequities in resources and resource allocation and access to care and how people are treated in the system, then I think that it gives a different set of possibilities for ethical deliberation. It's still going to be very hard, but I think it can get better.
Okay, so we're going to hear more about that when we come back from a quick break. So Professor Yolanda Wilson and Dr. Akila Jefferson-Shah are joining us today to talk about bioethics in the pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In a couple of days, we are going to be talking about the mutually beneficial impact of kindness, not just on the person who's on the receiving end of an act of kindness, but the person giving it as well. So we want to hear your stories. Did you receive an act of kindness at any point during this terrible pandemic? And how did it change you, and how did it make you feel? And did you give, when you were giving an act of kindness? Also want to hear how that changed you as a person. Tell us your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for a show we're doing on mutual impact and mutual benefit of kindness in a couple of days. Well, today we are talking about bioethics and the pandemic, and I'm joined by Professor Yolanda Wilson. She's a professor of philosophy at Howard University and a center at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Akila Jefferson-Shah joins us. She's an allergist, immunologist, and bioethicist at Arkansas's Children's Hospital and a professor at University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. And Dr. Jefferson-Shah, I had asked Professor Wilson before about whether ethical outcomes can be achieved or even truly ethical decision-making can happen in the U.S. healthcare system if, for the sake of argument, we just say for now that the healthcare system is fundamentally inequitable. And I wanted to hear what your thoughts on that might be.
So I agree with everything that Dr. Wilson mentioned, and I would kind of push back and say that the healthcare system is inequitable. So, you know, we have to work within that to make things better. I think for a very long time, bioethicists have, to your point, taken that for granted and assumed a reasonable level of equality here. And now I think there's a new wave of bioethics that's happening that really pushes that that point that we are truly living in an inequitable society, and that we cannot ignore that. And when I say that, one point, you know, for a lot of ethical decision making, many things are what we call colorblind or race neutral decisions. And that's something I found during the pandemic that we've been pushing back on a whole lot. How can we, if we know that things like racism are making a big impact on the way that people's health outcomes are, how can we make ethical decisions that are race neutral? We have to take that into account somehow. And I think the same thing for other issues that come up in a baseline inequitable society. We have to take that into consideration when we are making these decisions from an ethical lens.
Mm. Well, Professor Wilson, you had said a moment ago about how if we do start from that place of not presuming this sort of just healthcare backdrop, that would lead to a different way of thinking through these ethical questions. So what would be some of the differences?
So some of the underlying assumptions about, for instance, starting health status and why and what that looks like, right? I think you're going to, right, if you think about structural injustice or the role that structural inequality plays, then part of what's going to guide the ethical delivery is, are the choices we're making in this moment going to make things worse for this patient or for this community, given what we know about how this patient showed up in our institution in the first place? And that's going to be very different than these kind of race-neutral sensibilities about, you know, health status that seem to just happen abstractly with no kind of structural reality or being divorced from the lives that people actually live and how it comes to be that they live the lives that they live.
Mm. Well, I just want to take a pause here for a minute and hear from another physician, just kind of like their firsthand experience in an emergency room or in a hospital. And so, first of all, let's hear a little bit about the kinds of thoughts that this physician takes home with him every day.
At least half of my shifts when I'm driving home, I'm thinking to myself, did I do the right thing?
So that's Amal Mattu, an emergency physician at the University of Maryland Medical Center in Baltimore.
Every now and then I want to call back the hospital, and I even do call back the hospital and just find out if things are going well for a patient that I signed out.
Now, Dr. Mattu has been an emergency physician for more than 25 years. And in those 25 years, he says the ER has consistently delivered ethical or potentially life or death challenges. So ethical challenges. And then the pandemic happened.
You know, I'll be working a shift, for example, in the emergency department. We get this overhead that there's an unresponsive person out in front of the emergency department. Well, the first thing that you want to do, that you're trained to do, is you just go running out there and you'll find out what's going on. But you know what? You need to put all that stuff on before you go running out there. And that was difficult to do, but that's really what we have to do. The American Heart Association put out a statement about resuscitation of patients in cardiac arrest. And amongst the different things that they said was essentially that you as a healthcare provider need to, as a first priority, take care of yourself and take care of your staff. If you expose your staff to somebody who's COVID positive and they were not properly gowned and protecting themselves, they may be infected, or at the very least, they're going to need to quarantine for 14 days. And if you take members of the staff or yourself out of the game, you've just hurt a lot of people in your hospital. You've hurt your group. You've hurt other potential patients who now are going to lose you as a provider. You've hurt the system. Before you ever go into the room, you need to put the gown on, put the mask, two masks or the N95, or the respirator, the face mask on. You need to properly don all of the PPE before you go into the room. And that was tough to do because there were times where somebody would immediately be brought in and they're heading downhill and they're in cardiac arrest. And I can't go into the room until I take 2 or 3 minutes to put all this stuff on. It's very dysphoric. It feels like you're watching somebody go bad. And you know what? I need to think about myself first. That doesn't feel right. It doesn't sit right with what we've all been taught and kind of the reasons that we go into medicine in the first place, where you want to put the patient ahead of your own self. And in this pandemic, you're specifically told not to do that.
That's Dr. Amal Mattu, an emergency physician at the University of Maryland Medical Center in Baltimore. Dr. Jefferson Shaw, I'm wondering what you thought about what he said there about kind of the not good feeling that he had about the decisions that he had to make to protect himself and his staff for the greater good, in fact.
Right. I see where he's coming from. You know, this has been profoundly hard for those in the healthcare field. And to his point, you know, we're used to running literally to that, you know, that place where something bad is happening in the hopes that we can help people, that we can in some cases save people, you know, running towards danger, so to speak. And here, you know, for the greater good in a pandemic with an infectious disease, a novel infectious disease, we have to just pause for a moment in a way that I think we're not used to doing. I think that he, you know, the guidance there and the point that he's making is that we have to think of individual patients, but also we have to think of ourselves, our staff, our families, and the community before kind of just jumping into whatever we're doing and really giving ourselves a little grace to do that in the best way that we can. And so that's been, I think, very hard for most healthcare providers, figuring out the best ways to do this with our hands tied in so many different instances.
Hmm. Well, has the pandemic revealed the need, which I presume, I mean, I know the two of you have already been thinking about this, but to the rest of us about the need for a better way to make these decisions? And let's just stick to sort of the doctor-patient level for a moment. We'll stay micro here. I mean, Professor Wilson, are there the systems in place in most hospitals to help guide healthcare professionals through ethical decision-making on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it's certainly going to depend on the hospital, right? So a large university medical center, research hospital, those hospitals are likely to have those kinds of resources. Smaller hospitals, you may get a mix. And certainly, you know, the small rural hospitals may or may not have certainly a full-time trained ethicist on staff. And so they are making decisions with their personnel who perhaps took an ethics course or two as a part of their training, but not necessarily someone who is specifically trained as a bioethicist full-time. And I think that that's one of those places of inequity that Dr. Jefferson Shaw and I have been talking about throughout the hour, right? So it's not just, you know, the smaller hospitals often have, you know, physicians and nurses, but these other kinds of healthcare resources like bioethicists.
Dr. Jefferson Shaw, your thoughts?
I agree. It really depends on where you are. And this comes again into kind of place-based ways in which our health is impacted. Where you are, your zip code really makes a huge difference in everything. And there are, and you know, our universities, there are people trained to do this. We're trained to do this, and we've trained for a very long time to do it, and we still have a hard time making these decisions. And so it is unfortunate in many instances, but also a reality that many places don't have the luxury of having such resources. There are, in some places, you know, the ability to have things like virtual consults with larger medical centers so that you can have access to those resources. But again, if it's a decision that needs to be made quickly in the middle of the night and things like that, which happens particularly during this pandemic, it really just highlights the inequalities that we've already seen in the healthcare system.
So is there an opportunity here? I mean, because the pandemic really has brought everything into so much sharper relief, right? Like the problems and challenges were already there, but now they're just inescapable, right? Because we cannot avoid them. They are there for all to see. So, but is there an opportunity to think differently about ethics in American healthcare? And if so, Professor Wilson, how would you take advantage of that opportunity? What would you like to see changed?
Right. So there's certainly the opportunity. And I think that part of what's going to determine what gets taken advantage of and how much is going to just be, you know, public will, institutional will, federal and state and local will to make these things happen. So a conversation that I've been having a lot over in recent months have been with kind of educational institutions and thinking about curricular changes and development to really incorporate not just thinking about ethics, but thinking about ethics in the context of structural injustice. And so I think when you're talking about training the kind of coming generation of providers and clinicians, I think that this is going to be an important opportunity here. Now, when you think about kind of federal funding for hospitals or government funding, I think that there's a space for ethics to be built into those frameworks and resources. That having a bioethicist nearby or directly on staff isn't just a luxury for research institutions, but that it is, you know, the kind of thing that is as necessary as having some of the other positions to staff one's hospital.
Mm. Do you think that's really possible in the long run? I mean, I'm kind of an optimist tempered by my realism because of what, you know, Dr. Jefferson Shaw pointed out earlier. And in fact, both of you have said that, look, we have a system right now mm-hmm. by virtue of the economic pressures on those system, on that system, that just isn't built to create the kind of spaces or opportunities or supports needed for the best ethical decision-making. And for as long as those drivers in the healthcare system don't change, like, can we really get to a better place?
Yeah. Oh, so I thought you were just getting me to imagine fantasy.
I was.
Oh, yeah. No.
I was.
Oh, yeah, no, that's not
going to
happen.
And then I tore down your fantasy.
Yeah, no, that's not happening. Like, we're going to talk about it for a while, and then things will just go back to where they
were. I like
the
big ideas, and then kind of have to be, and then... But we can't
and
do
then
it. Yeah.
Here's what's really going to happen. Yeah. So, I mean, I think about even my hometown, right? So I'm from a very small, my mother gets offended when I describe it as a very small town. So I'm from a place called Albany, Georgia, that, you know, if you watch the news, say in March and April, our per capita COVID rate was much higher than New York. In fact, we were number 3 in the world at a time when New York was number 7 in the world, but New York dominated the news, of course, because of the sheer numbers. But when you think about a community of about 70,000 people, and it's the only major hospital for 60 miles, and what that devastation looks like, you know, I think that this is one of the spaces where, you know, we think about inequity in resources and resource allocation. And I don't see putting a bioethicist on staff is probably high priority in places where there's, you know, maybe one major hospital mm-hmm. for 50 or 60 miles.
Yeah.
Although those are precisely the places where you might want to have a trained bioethicist.
Dr. Jefferson Shaw, I'm afraid we only got about 30 seconds left, but I'll let you have the last word today.
I'll end on an optimistic point. I think, you know, in the news there have been lots of stories about the influx of medical school applications, and I do think that this is going to make a change. I think if we have people who are cross-trained in ethics and in things like medicine or nursing or philosophy or the law, that we can, you know, staff these places like Albany, Georgia, and others that are understaffed and really provide a service that is really needed, particularly during this time.
Well, Dr. Akilah Jefferson-Shaw is an allergist, immunologist, and bioethicist at Arkansas's Children's Hospital, joining us today from Little Rock. Dr. Jefferson-Shaw, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Yolanda Wilson, professor of philosophy at Howard University and a fellow at the National Humanities Center, former visiting scholar in bioethics at the National Institutes of Health. Professor Wilson, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.